message that it's trying to convey for us. We talked about how the book of Leviticus was a book that was first taught to the children, the first book taught to the children. And then last week, we spent a lot of time talking about the fact that God is holy, holy, holy. And I will not pick up where we ended off. There's still, I forget how many more points from that class. I'm going to skip over those. If we have time in the sixth week, we won't. But if we do, I'll just say we'll come back to that. Or if one of the young men or Scott wants to, yeah, that was a dig. wants to have my notes. I mean, anybody wants my slides, I'm happy to share them. But if Matt or somebody wants to teach further later on or preach a lesson from some of these, that's fine with me. A lot of the material I've stolen from somebody else, so if somebody can take it from me and use it, to God be the glory. And so tonight we're going to talk about the first seven chapters of the of the book of Leviticus. And so that's a chunk to bite off, chapters 1 through 7. What we're going to do is just overview of what those chapters are and then look at some applications from it. And again, one of the things I'm hoping is that this will spur you on to further reading, deeper reading, more careful reading, and that maybe as a result of tonight's lessons, you'll have some other questions or some other thoughts, not just questions, but you'll have some comments or some thoughts, certainly would welcome those during the class or afterward. I'm happy to come back to this as time will allow us to do so. But this is, I think, a pretty good way to kind of break down the book so that we're not as intimidated by it. If you can think of those first seven chapters as trying to convey this message of how to be accepted by God, that's what these chapters are about. I'll try to prove that as we go through. We talked about those boring sacrifices last week. They're not at all. And the very last verse in the book, this is for the children of Israel. It's not for the priest. It's not for the Levites. It's for them also. But the book of Leviticus is for the children of Israel. It's for all of the Israelites. They were all expected to know that. Jonathan mentioned a while ago, even studying the book of Ruth, one of the things that you rely on is the book of Leviticus. The whole thought about Boaz coming and claiming that near kinsman, that comes from Leviticus 25:25. Leviticus is just sprinkled all throughout the Old Testament and the New Testament, and that teaching there in Ruth, for example, it becomes meaningful if you know the background to that. They're not just pulling that out of the air of who's going to get this property and that sort of thing. That's part of the law. God had provided for people like Naomi and Ruth to be taken care of. And so one of the beautiful things about Leviticus is that you begin to see it just crop up all over the place. I was really excited when he mentioned that in his talk a little bit ago. So let's talk a little bit about these sacrifices and looking at the first seven chapters of Leviticus. You have in chapter 1 what's called the burnt offering. You may have other words that are used for some of these offerings, but this is at least one of the ones that's acceptable, I think. In verse 3, if his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd and so forth. So this is a burnt offering, and the idea of the burnt offering is that of consecration. And the way these seven chapters are divided, at first he goes through and he's going to talk about five different kinds of sacrifices. The fifth one is really, it's sort of like 4A and 4B, the sin offering and then the sin offering that requires restitution. But we'll call it five different offerings that are being given. And after he talks about each of those in these first five chapters, then he's going to come back beginning in chapter 6 and in verse 8 to talk about what the priest ought to do. So in chapter 1, he's going to talk about this burnt offering and what the person needs to do in regard to that burnt offering. And then after he talks about all those sacrifices, then he's going to say, and you priest, here's what your job is in relationship to that. So sometimes people are confused about how this is broken down. Chapter 1 goes along with chapter 6, verses 8 through 13. and it's all talking about the burnt offering. I'll just mention, I don't have this on the slide, but in chapter 1, you can really break this down into bite-sized chunks, this burnt offering. Verses 3 through 9 is talking about the sacrifice if it comes from the herd. In verses 10 through 13, if it comes from the flock. And then verses 14 through 17, if it comes from the birds. And so there's three different options for this burnt offering. If it's from the herd, you do this. If it's from the flock, you do this. If it's of the birds, then you do this. Do I see that maybe in verse 3, you see the word herd. In verse 10, you see flocks, sheep, or goats. And then in verse 14, birds, turtle doves, or pigeons. And so the way this is broken down is it's really handy. It takes away confusion in a lot of ways as far as the details of what's to be done. And then I borrowed some quotes from what I think of as a really good book. I mentioned Wenham's book last week. That's a really handy one. Also, Alan P. Ross has a book called Holiness to the Lord, which to me is my favorite book on commentary on Leviticus. I don't make any money off of it, but I would recommend if you're wanting to get a commentary on Leviticus, that book, Holiness to the Lord, there's the title of it, Alan P. Ross. When he describes, and this is just, as I read through it, I just pulled out some quotes that I thought, this kind of captures the sense of the purpose of a sacrifice. And so he describes it in this way, regarding this consecration, this burnt offering. The Lord accepts with pleasure whoever comes into his presence by substitutionary atonement through the shedding of blood. And so there's going to be shedding of blood. These animals are going to be sacrificed. And the idea is to be consecrated, to be sanctified, to come into God's presence, to enjoy fellowship with Him. I think that's really the simple thing. One of the challenges in chapters 1 through 7 is you don't have a lot of discussion about what the purpose of the sacrifices are. It's just a lot of details about how to perform the sacrifices. And that maybe throws us off a little bit. You're like, well, he doesn't tell us why to do it. He just tells us what to do, and he gives a name for it. But one of the things that you'll do, and we just don't have time to do this in a class period, but all throughout the rest of the Old Testament, I mean, over and over and over, you're going to read about these sacrifices. And so pay attention as you come across a burnt offering or one of the other sacrifices we're going to talk about here in a minute. Just think about, oh, here's where they did this. This is why. This sacrifice is appropriate. So the other passages will help to explain the why of this. And I think that this kind of captures that idea. Again, as last week in all of my classes, if you have any comments, questions, objections, disagreements, please feel free to throw those out at any time. The second offering in chapter 2 is a grain offering. And this grain offering is more for the sense of dedication. You have the grain offering talked about in chapter 2. That's what the Israelite is going to do. And then he comes back in chapter 6, verses 14 through 23, to talk about what the priest does in connection with that. Again, it's broken down pretty handy, verses 1 through 3, and then 4 through 10, and then 11 through 16. You have this description of the offerings that are made for us. And again, just for time's sake, I'm going to skip through this somewhat quickly. Happy to back up if we need to. Ross describes this grain offering as those who are loyally dedicated to the covenant will offer themselves and the best that they have to the Lord. And so this is sort of symbolic of them giving themselves to God. This grain offering is. Same sort of thing, the peace offering is that of having fellowship and communion with God, chapter 3, and then again later on in chapter 7. And Ross describes those as those who surrender their hearts to God and come before Him on the basis of the shed blood of the sacrifice may celebrate being at peace with God. And so it's a communal meal that takes place. This is kind of a unique sacrifice that is given here, this peace offering in the way that it's eaten and so forth in the text. The sin offering in chapter 4 is described in verses 1 through 5 and verse 13. chapter 4, verse 1 through 5:13, excuse me, and then what the priest does in later on in chapter 6, God will restore the sinner who appeals to him for forgiveness on the basis of the purifying blood of the sacrifice. And then the fifth one, the sacrifice, the sin offering that requires some restitution or restoration, I guess is the word that I used there. Again, anyone who becomes aware of the obligations left undone or impure contacts left unpurified must make confession and find forgiveness through God's provision of atonement. And so that just kind of runs through the nuts and bolts. And again, I can give you the breakdown of how I view that those chapters and so forth. Happy to do that. I just don't want to get lost in the woods, in the trees in this class. I'm more than happy to back up and talk about what I know of these sacrifices. Again, I think the real benefit is when you begin to read about them later on in the Bible, then you start to see, oh, this is why that's given. Scott?
Yeah, on the phrases, do they show up within the text of Leviticus, or is this your summation or Ross's summation, and yeah, you kind of flesh out, of course, what those differences are?
Sure, yeah, I'd be happy to try to do that. So some of them seem to blend together in my mind. Again, what I try to do is when I'm reading through the rest of the scriptures, I try to pick those out, and what I should have done is just pick some samples of these sacrifices being given in different passages. Maybe I'll try to do that later on. But those words are not used, I don't think, in the text. And so this is Ross's words that are used. You'll find other descriptions of them in other commentaries and so forth. But I do think that that's the idea. So let me see, where will I? Hold me to that, and I will get to that, okay? Any other thoughts on that? I've got two slides. I think I'll get to at least some of that. So, what can we gain? You know, I think I mentioned last week that I kind of view Leviticus like an encyclopedia, that I'm going to benefit by when I'm maybe studying something else, I come back and use this as a reference, or because of what I know from the book, other passages become more meaningful. Here's one of the applications to that. I don't know if you've thought a lot about Oreos in the morning or not, but I do, because the whole time that I lived in Fairlawn, New Jersey, the street that I lived on was about a half a mile from the Nabisco plant. And I would get up in the morning, and you're just going to take my word on this, I was trying to get in shape. And so I would get up in the morning to go for a run, and I'd walk out of my house, and they had already been firing up those furnaces and started cooking those Oreos, making those Oreos. And I'd walk out for a run. Oh, it just hit you, and I would run back to the kitchen. Just think about that sense of just something that is just really good smelling, okay? Just like capture whatever that is for you. You're driving by a barbecue joint or something, you know, just something just really captures the flavor just captures your senses. That's what Leviticus chapters 1 through 7, I think, is a lot about. This idea of a sweet aroma to the Lord. Look with me in your Bibles at these passages. I'll have them on the slide in just a second, but I want you to be impressed with them in your Bible. Look at chapter 1. And so in verses 3 through 9, you have this burnt offering, and that's the herd in verses 3 through 9. And at the end of that, what seems like just a lot of butchering details, you know, how the animals will be cut up, what's supposed to happen to it, you know, all those different things. Then in verse 9, he says, he shall wash its entrails and its legs with water. The priest shall burn all on the altar as a burnt sacrifice, an offering made by fire, a sweet aroma to the Lord. There's probably some other translations. What else might you have?
Soothing aroma.
Soothing aroma. Anything else? Pleasing aroma, but I think pretty consistently aroma is one of the words that comes up. And so that
ought to tell us, you know, the translations all have that concept of it's something that there's a smell as if God had nostrils and is that's pleasing to God. Now, it's not that God is hungry and, you know, that just makes him happy, but there's something about this sacrifice that is pleasing to the Lord. And so that's stated at the end of this herd sacrifice in verse 9. It's stated at the end of, in verse 13 for the flock sacrifice. Do you see it in verse 13? The very last phrase, sweet aroma to the Lord. And for the bird sacrifice, at the end of verse 17, a sweet aroma to the Lord. For the grain offering, it's mentioned at the end of chapter 2 and verse 2, a sweet aroma to the Lord. At the end of chapter 2 and verse 9, a sweet aroma to the Lord. The peace offering, in chapter 3, the end of verse 5, a sweet aroma to the Lord. And again, in toward the end of verse 16, for a sweet aroma, all the fat is the Lord's. And then for the sin offering in chapter 4, and in verse 31, he shall remove all its fat. This fat is removed from the sacrifice, the peace offering. The priest shall burn it on the altar for a sweet aroma to the Lord. And then skip over to chapter 6. And verse 15, he shall take from it his handful of fine flour, the grain offering with its oil and all the frankincense which is on the grain offering, and shall burn it on the altar for a sweet aroma as a memorial to the Lord. And then again in verse 21, the very end of verse 21, a sweet aroma to the Lord. I may have even missed one of those when I was just running through them, but there they are, at least the ones that I have found. It's mentioned for every sacrifice. That impresses me. All of these sacrifices, the purpose is that you're offering these up to God, and when they're done properly from the right heart, then that's going to be pleasing to God. Now, I think there's just some automatic applications for us. When we offer sacrifices, when we give offerings to God in the right manner and with the right heart, God is pleased with those. That's not just Joe saying that. That's what the Bible is going to teach us. This idea of a sweet aroma to the Lord goes all the way back to the book of Genesis. When Noah came out of the ark in Genesis, the 8th chapter, and he offered up a sacrifice to God, it says the same phrase, that it was a sweet aroma to the Lord. If you're like me, you'll be amazed at how much, the more you study Leviticus, Genesis is all over it. So many of, this is just sort of a sidebar, this is a good place to throw it in though. Leviticus gives a lot of rules and laws and prohibitions. They go along with Genesis. One of the things you find is that the stories that are given in Genesis often correspond with something that's in the book of Leviticus. Like, say, not marrying a girl and her sister. Do you think of anything in the book of Genesis that connects with that?
Jacob.
Yeah. What was Jacob? And so, when you read that story in Genesis, you think, that didn't go real well, did it? You know, all that rivalry and jealousy and competition and everything else. And you have that prohibition given in Leviticus. There's a number of times that happens. It's over and over and over. There's several lessons that can be taught from tying Genesis and Leviticus. Just a lot. I've got some slides maybe we'll get to in a future lesson. But this is one of them. We first see this. Here's something I think is really handy. So you see this idea of a sweet aroma to the Lord talked about a lot here in these first seven chapters. It's mentioned again towards the end of the book. Look over at Leviticus chapter 26. In Leviticus 26, you have these warnings from God. Well, first off, he talks about that if they follow after him, all these blessings are going to come. But if they forget God, then there's going to be all of these consequences to that. If they don't obey him, if they walk contrary to him, you have those phrases like in verse 18 and verse 21. But you drop down to chapter 26 and verse 31. If they are practicing this idolatry, he talks about, I will destroy your high places, cut down your incense altars, cast your carcasses on the lifeless forms of your idols, and my soul shall abhor you. It's verse 30, 31.
I will lay your cities waste and bring your sanctuary to desolation, and I will not smell the fragrance of your sweet aromas. God says, I'm not going to smell them. If you've been offering them up to idols, I'm not going to smell them. So it's a good contrast, right? If you offer up properly, then it's a sweet aroma to the God. To God. But if you don't, and then drop over to the book of Ezekiel in chapter 6. Now, if you're familiar with the book of Ezekiel, what's one of the things that these first several chapters are dealing with? What's going on amongst the children of Israel in Jerusalem, in the temple even? All kinds of idolatry, right? And so look at chapter 6 and verse 13. Then you shall know that I am the Lord when their slain men are among their idols all around their altars, on every high hill and on every mountaintop, under every green tree and under every thick oak, wherever they offered sweet incense to all their idols. So just what Leviticus 26:31 said, that they would be slain among their altars, Ezekiel says that's what's happening. And so Leviticus 26 is a warning. Ezekiel 6:13 is the fulfillment of that. But it's because they weren't following Leviticus 1 through 7. So again, it's not just about the details. It's about the heart. It's about serving God in the right way. And so those are some neat connections. Again, I think that we ought to be able to make some practical applications from that. But sometimes I'm just a little too dense. Sometimes I'm kind of slow at picking up on, where exactly should I make the application? And so I'm always thankful because God knows how slow I am sometimes, and he makes those applications for me. Ephesians, the 5th chapter. In Ephesians chapter 5. It says in verse 2, walk in love as Christ also has loved us and given himself for us, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling aroma. Jesus is the fulfillment of Leviticus 1 through 7. Jesus is that perfect sacrifice. And this passage, amongst a host of others, probably about a dozen times in the book of Hebrews, you have Jesus being described here as both the high priest and as the sacrifice simultaneously. I just love how the scriptures do that. Whenever we sing songs like, he is everything to me, this is what comes to my mind. He's both the one who is offering it up as the great and merciful high priest, and he is the perfect sacrifice at the same time. That just blows my mind. But I'm so thankful that God has done that, has seen to it. But Jesus is this sweet aroma. And so, okay, good. Now I get it. These things were pointing to Christ. They were wanting us to see, you know, like the blood of bulls and goats and that sort of thing, right? Hebrews 9. Christ fulfills all of that. But we don't just stop with appreciation when we're studying Leviticus. We also have to think about application. And so go on to the next book in the book of Philippians. In Philippians 4 and in verse 18. Indeed, I have all and abound. I am full, having received from Epaphroditus the things which were sent from you, a sweet-smelling aroma, an acceptable sacrifice, well-pleasing to God. Philippians 4, 10 through 18. What's the context? Somebody remember what's going on there in Philippians 4? Just give us two or three sentences of what's happening there.
Epaphroditus had brought more funds for Philippi to Paul while he's a prisoner, and Paul sends back this thing.
So they have sent some support to help take care of Paul while he's there suffering, and like he had in Philippi as well. And so the Philippians are sharing in that, and he describes what they have sent to him as in sacrificial terms. I'll confess, when I first started preaching, you know, I don't know if others, well, I do know others are like this. Thankfully, not everybody is. But I sort of took on that sort of rebellious tone, and I would challenge all of the phrases that older preachers use and things. And like the five acts of worship, that just really turned me off to think about five acts of worship as if that's all that there is and so forth. And I think there's a lot more to worship than just five acts that we do together. Maybe that's for a different conversation. But one of the things I had trouble with was,
I see how we worship God in song and in prayer and in partaking the Lord's Supper. And what am I leaving out? Preaching. I better not leave out. But I thought, giving. How am I worshiping God with giving? It's a command. It's something that I do. But I just sort of left a bad taste in my mouth to think about that I'm worshiping God with money. That just seemed kind of carnal to me in my superficial understanding of the scriptures. But then finding passages like this, and thankfully some older preachers were able to beat this into me, we do. We worship God with our offering. I remember I taught this one time down in Alabama, and after I talked through this, the church was going to be supporting me when I lived in Brazil. And after I talked about this text in Philippians 4 and about how the offering that they were sending to Paul was really, they were giving it to God. That's what Paul says here in Philippians 4:18. They were giving it to God. They were offering it up to God, and God was pleased with that. And there was an older lady that walked at the end of the service. I was back there at the preacher perch, and this older lady came through, and she said, "The money that I give to God, when I put it in place, it's going to you." And she said, "That's what I'm thinking about. This money that I put in, I want to give to you." And she wasn't making a specific distinction. She was just excited about supporting the work in South America. The lady right behind her said, "Oh, I've just never thought about this. I guess I would have been paying the light bill." And there's her confession, like mine, that I just not thought enough about. The giving is not just to take care of the building, and it's not just to support preachers. We're offering it up to God. And we need to do it in the right manner. And we need to do it with the right heart. So other passages like 2 Corinthians 8 and 9 come to mind. But this ought to be one of them. And the reason why we can appreciate the terminology here in Philippians 4:18 is because of Leviticus 1 through 7. I don't think that we would catch that, how strong this is, if we didn't realize that all of the sacrifices that God had instructed the Israelites to perform through the Old Testament were intended to be sweet-smelling aroma to God. So is our giving. For whatever it's going to be used for, it's first being given to God. In Philippians 13, verses 15 and 16, you have another phrase that's used. It's not the exact same phrase, but I think it conveys the same idea. Feel free to disagree with me on this. Hebrews 13, 15. Therefore, by him, let us continually offer up the sacrifice of praise to God, that is, the fruit of our lips, giving thanks to God. Do not forget to do good and to share, for with such sacrifices, God is well pleased. That idea of well-pleasing to God, sacrifices, being well-pleasing to God, the sacrifice of praise. And so you have this sense of the songs that we sing, they need to be from the heart, they need to be scriptural, they need to be according to God's word, but they also need to be from the heart for God to accept them. And even the very concept of sharing in verse 16, that's a sacrifice that needs to be given. And so those are just some of the New Testament examples that we find at applications, appreciations and applications from Leviticus 1 through 7. Does that make sense? So when we're studying through the Old Testament, Ezekiel 6:13, for example, or the New Testament, all these other passages, you're going to benefit by having that reference point from Leviticus 1 through 7. That's what part of my goal is for this section. What time do I need to stop again? 8:30, okay. All right. And then, of course, thinking about this one, Romans 12, right? I beseech you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, that you present your bodies a living sacrifice, holy, acceptable to God, which is your reasonable service. And so our very being needs to be a sacrifice to God. Everything about us. It's not just what we give or what we say. It's about who we are. Our very being needs to be a sacrifice to God. So what will we offer to God? Let's think about that a little bit, and maybe this will help to answer some of Scott's question. If I go slow enough, maybe I'll have another week to think about it even more.
Or two, right? Because we're the gospel meetings next week. So Leviticus 1, this burnt offering. Consider what's taking place here. You know, you're wanting to have this, you're going to offer up this burnt sacrifice of the herd to God, or maybe it's from the flock, or maybe it's from the birds in Leviticus 1. Just sort of picture what's taking place here. Imagine this scene, if you will. You walk into your little herd, and you pick out the very best flock, or you go into your flock. You pick out the very best sheep that you can find that matches the instructions for the sacrifice. And you put a rope around its neck, and you lead it off to the tabernacle. And you walk into the courtyard there, and as you walk in, you all study this Exodus. And so the first thing that you meet is the altar of burnt sacrifice, altar of burnt offering, and then the bronze laver, and then the tabernacle tent door is right there beyond that. And so on the altar of burnt offering are four horns, one on each corner. And the scriptures teach that what they would do is they would bring their sacrifice and they would tie it to one of those horns. They'd take the rope and they would bind it. I think that's, well, maybe we'll get to Psalm 118 at some point. 22 through 25, it talks about binding the sacrifice to the altar. I think maybe even pointing to Christ being bound as the sacrifice. That's my conclusion. Certainly Psalm 118, those verses are pointing to Christ. And so that would be the application I'd be there. But I digress, which I do often. So imagine this. You've taken the sheep. It's precious to you. You've provided for it. You've fed it. You've taken care of it. And now it's going to be slaughtered. It's going to be killed. And so you bring it. You tie it there on the altar. And there's the priest standing there with a knife. And you know what's going to happen. And this isn't to prepare supper. This is a sacrifice that's being given. And so you hand that rope off to the priest, and he ties it on one of those horns, and you then begin your journey home. And your whole journey home, you're thinking about what's taking place back there, what that priest is doing, and how it's going to be killed, and all that horror of that. And if that's what you have in mind, that's not what the scriptures teach. Look at Leviticus 1, and in verse 4, beginning of verse 3. If his offering is a burnt sacrifice of the herd, let him offer a male without blemish. He shall offer of his own free will at the door of the tabernacle of meeting before the Lord. Then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement for him. He shall kill the bull before the Lord and the priest, Aaron's sons, and the priest, Aaron's sons, shall bring the blood and sprinkle the blood all around. You see, it's not just that the animal is tied there and you go home thinking about what's happened. They hand you the knife. The text, look at the pronouns. The one who brings it is the one who puts his hand on the head of the animal and kills that animal. It becomes very personal here. And I don't know if you thought about this or not, but how many of you all ever hunted, you know, and you've had the skin of deer or whatever, or maybe on the farm, you know, with other animals. And I grew up, my grandparents had a farm, and one of the things that became very obvious early on is that there's no really clean way. You can't stay clean when you kill an animal. It just doesn't happen. Maybe today some processing plants that takes place, but on a farm or whatever, that you get blood on your hands. And I'm just picturing, as that knife begins to slice, that blood just begins to come over your hands. And it probably drips down, maybe it's on your sandals. And I'm not going to add things to the text. I think this is what the text is describing. These sacrifices, blood is being poured out, life is being taken. And I'm recognizing that this animal is going to be slaughtered so that I can be accepted.
That's what verse 4 says, right? Then he shall put his hand on the head of the burnt offering, and it will be accepted on his behalf to make atonement. And so instead of me going and being healed, it's this animal that's going to be accepted on my behalf. He uses the word atonement here in verse 4. At least that's what the New King James, I think it's pretty consistent, right? What's the atonement? What does that mean? Do I have a thought on that?
The
price of sin. Okay, that really covers it. Hopefully it never gets easier. But yeah, you're exactly right. This is just a powerful scene that's unfolding, and one that would have been played over and over for the Israelites going through this. So somebody described this, and others will argue with it. It's okay. I think the message is good. If it's only convenient, that's okay. Atonement, break the word down, at one moment. I think, I'm no grammatician, but I think that really helps us to get it. It's so that we can be at one with God. And so atonement, you'll see the idea of covering. It's the, getting ahead of myself in my notes. So the word atonement is used 102 times in the Old Testament. 44 times, almost half of its usage, is in the book of Leviticus. If you view atonement as something important, again, like holy, 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 last week, atonement, if you want to know about atonement, you have to know Leviticus. That's where you're going to understand being made one with God. I guess maybe I didn't put this in the slides, but the idea of atonement is the same word that's used in Genesis 6, I forget what verse, when it talks about that Noah covered the ark with pitch. The word covered there is the same Hebrew word for atonement. It's the exact same word as used here. And so, to me, that's helpful. It's a covering. Our sins are being covered. And whether that means like they're being hidden, they're taken out of view, I think that's one way that sometimes people can view this. Others have seen it in the sense of, I have it covered, we might say. I've taken care of that. You have a bill that you can't pay, and somebody comes along and says, oh, I've got that covered. Maybe that helps. I think it's probably more of the idea of having it covered over, taken out of sight. That seems to me to be the idea. But whatever works, it's the idea of it being removed, it being taken away. Yeah.
The cost of sin is right in your face here.
Absolutely. I think that's really helpful. We'll talk more about sin offerings in chapters 4 and 5. But I think the sense here of even coming into God's presence, even being accepted by Him, it requires this sacrifice. We're not pure in and of ourselves, so sacrifice is required. Teacher? Great application. Wonderful.
That's really helpful. Maybe we should dwell on that more. Sometimes we spend a lot of time talking about the bread, and then when we get to the second aspect, we sort of quickly go into a prayer. I'm not condemning anybody on that. I've been guilty of that as well. But I think that there needs to be good understanding and dwelling on that. A good point. Scott?
On the sacrifices here, if you have time to comment, and do I understand correctly, like back in Exodus 29, we see sacrifices where the priests are being able to eat.
Right.
The meat, and some people do them, and we see Eli some using that. But it looks like the burnt offerings here in chapter 1, the burnt offering, the priest is not getting that. It looks like that's a bad animal is completely burned up.
Completely given to God. That's exactly right. Yeah, yeah. So as you read through them, you'll see different ones, and I'll have to think about that. So in chapter 3, right, I'm not going to find the verse really quickly here. But yes, maybe I should just save that one, and I'll try to answer that with better verses. But you're exactly right. For some of them, the priest gets the sacrifice, the meat, and on others, it's completely devoted to God. Kind of like some of the spoils and battles and so forth, even the first is given to God. Yeah, that's a good point. Let me just run through some of these. So in chapter 2 and verse 13, here's something I try to point out to people for this grain offering. Every offering of your grain offering you shall season with salt. You shall not allow the salt of the covenant of your God to be lacking from your grain offering. With all of your offerings you shall offer salt. I wonder what the point of that verse is. Three times, don't forget the salt. Put salt in it. Never leave the salt out. It's like, wow, he wants this to be salty, doesn't he? Why is that? What's salt? Yeah, Matthew 5, it helps us, I think, to appreciate that concept even. So, yeah. Very valuable and preservative. It helps things to last. And so this covenant, this sacrifice, is intended to be lasting. A couple of verses in Numbers 18, 19. Let's see if I got that right. Was it 19, 18? 18, 19. Numbers 18, 19. All the heave offerings of the holy things which the children of Israel offer to the Lord, I have given to you and your sons and daughters with you as an ordinance forever. It is a covenant of salt forever before the Lord with you and your descendants with you. And so twice he says there in Numbers 18, 19 that it is a perpetual covenant. And he uses salt to symbolize that. The covenant was made with David in 2 Chronicles 13, 5. What is it? Abijah speaking to Jeroboam. He talks about how, no, the family of David are the kings. It was a covenant that God made with David, a covenant of salt. And so that sense of a salt covenant is a perpetual covenant. That's the significance behind this. One of the things that I try to do, I'm just a really simple reader and teacher, I think. I just look for repetitive words. If I can find repetitive words, then that's the point that God's making. You know, he's emphasizing that. So you come across something like this three times in one verse, salt. I want to study that more. I want to think about that. And then every time I come across salt, it may not always come back to this, but boy, I'm going to think hard about that salt sacrifice being tied together with that. Man, you're going to ring that too early. Okay, well, we'll stop there. You've got the peace offering. It's a sacrifice of thanksgiving, he says, in chapter 7. And so make sure you read both what the people are supposed to do and what the priest is supposed to do. That's helpful for us, I think. This offering that's given, he says in verses 11 and 12, this is the law of the sacrifice of peace offerings, which he shall offer to the Lord. If he offers it for a thanksgiving, then shall offer with a sacrifice of thanksgiving unleavened cakes mixed with oil, cakes finally blended. It's a thanksgiving. And so again, that spirit of giving thanks through this sacrifice. Perhaps, what, a dozen, 20, 30 verses come to your mind to think about offering up with thanksgiving throughout the New Testament even. In chapter 4, I'm behind on my slides. In chapter 4, the sin offerings are for unintentional sins. Pay attention to that. Don't have time to go through it. All of those verses talk about this sin offering is for unintentional sins. Okay? not high-handed, rebellious. I don't care what God thinks. I'm going to do it my way, and I'll offer up a sacrifice later. We see some examples of people doing that sort of thing, like Saul, and their sacrifices aren't going to be accepted, right? These are for unintentional sins that are given there. The priest shall make atonement. You have all of that. And so, again, just to ask for your indulgence here, look over at Hebrews 10. Put those two thoughts together. Look at Hebrews, the 10th chapter. Unintentional sins and atonement being made. In Hebrews 10:26, we sort of read this text, or we're tempted to read this text in a vacuum, not in mind of the rest of Hebrews. I mean, the whole book of Hebrews is about this priesthood, Moses, Aaron, sacrifices, tabernacle. Those are all the contrasts that he's making, right? All throughout the book of Hebrews. Well, then, continue that thought when you get to Hebrews 10. We're not just talking about don't skip assemblies. We're still talking about those same contrasts. Look at verse 26. For if we sin willfully after we've received the knowledge of the truth, there no longer remains a sacrifice for sins. You see how that corresponds with what those sacrifices back there? The offering for sin was for unintentional sins. In the Old Testament, same thing is true for us here. But a certain fearful expectation of judgment, fire, and indignation, which will devour the adversaries. Anyone who has rejected Moses' law dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of how much worse punishment do you suppose will be thought worthy who has trampled the Son of God underfoot, counted the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified a common thing, an insult to the Spirit of grace? To me, Hebrews 10, 26 through 29 is screaming Leviticus. That's the point here. These sacrifices, you can't just go do whatever you want to do and then think that God is going to accept you later on. That's not the way that God operates. You can't just offer up something and to be a substitute for us while we continue doing what we're wanting to do. And so if we're going to sin willfully, coming together, not forsaking the assembling, encourages us by thinking about the blood, like what TJ was talking about and so forth, that encourages us not to sin willfully. 25 and 26, they go together. You know, put your finger over verse 26 and just keep reading. Those things are tied together there. I think that's the benefit. When you begin to see these patterns, and again, I'm just looking for things that are repeated over and over. Unintentional sins. Making atonement. You sin willfully, there's no atonement. You have counted the blood of the covenant by which you were sanctified a common thing. And that just can't be. I'm way out of time. Thank you all very much. I really appreciate, again, the opportunity to teach tonight.